Father, we thank you for this time together. We thank you for just the fact that you've called us to be a part of your church, to see it grow. And we thank you for the opportunities you give us every day to minister in that place. So I just pray for our time together today that it's productive and profitable for all those here, and just bless our time. We pray this in Christ's name. Amen. A couple things. My name is Ron Tobias. I'm the executive pastor of Spanish River Church in Boca Raton, Florida. Boca Raton is paradise. In case you've never been to Boca Raton, it's the place to live. Anybody ever been to Boca Raton? Oh man, really? Okay. So you know. And so we're going to talk about fundraising. The title they gave me, and I didn't choose this title, it's Fundraising with Integrity. I'd rather talk about fundraising, just fundraising, because then I can tell you all the really good things to do. But they dropped the integrity part in there, so I don't really know what to talk about now. But we'll figure that out. But I got a couple principles that I've learned over the years, and a couple points to those principles. So we're going to kind of go through those, and then we're going to leave some time at the end for just Q&A. And a couple things about our church. Spanish River Church is a 50-year-old church located, like I said, in Boca Raton, Florida. Boca Raton is a high-income area. People that have a lot of money go there and live there. And because of that, our church is always been somewhat generous in church planting. We've been really started church planting about 35 years ago. And over those years, we've helped start over 450 churches around the world, 24 different countries. And somewhere around 16, 17 million has gone towards that effort in that period of time. So it's what we do. It's the focus of our church. And we both, so from the fundraising aspect, yeah, I kind of sit on the board and I make decisions on who to fund, and also have to go out and visit members and donors and raise money. So I kind of sit in both those worlds. How many of you guys are in the process of raising money for your church right now? You should always be in the process of raising money for your church. I mean, you never stop, right? So it's always a thing you're doing. But a couple things that I've learned over the years, I think that I want to share with you. And it's interesting, as I was trying to think through this, I had 3 points, and then someone brought up prayer to me, and I thought, yeah, it's a pretty good idea to pray about it. It's amazing how sometimes that just kind of slips to the back, and or maybe just even becomes assumed and never happens. But last year I got really convicted of this. So we were having our church planters retreat. We invite church planters that we fund to come in, and then guys that are making proposals to come meet with us. And we had about 32 proposals listened to of guys who were coming to our church to ask for money. And the interesting thing about last year is we didn't have any money. We had made enough commitments for 2015 that we were basically overcommitted to the 70-some churches we were already funding. And but we went through and we listened to all the proposals, and I did something that I don't normally do during that week. We didn't make any decisions that week. What I asked our board to do, and our board is mostly businessmen, I said, I want you to take 2 weeks. So we listened to all the proposals over 3 days, and then we basically sent them away with that information and asked them to pray for 2 weeks about who it was we were going to fund. Not the amount, but just who it was we could partner with. And we have to look at things like theology and the fact that they can, whether or not they'll become self-sustaining, or where they have a vision for becoming a church planting church. So there's a lot of different variables we look at, we make those decisions. And they did. They went away and they prayed, came back 2 weeks later. We basically agreed to fund 28 of those 32 churches, and it was kind of cool that we were all unanimous on all those 28. But we still didn't vote on how much money. And the reason is we didn't have any. And so I told them, I said, okay, here's the deal. Now we need to figure out how much, and we need to start praying that God would, you know, bring those resources in. So we needed about, I kind of did a quick calculation over what I thought we would need, and it was around $550,000 before January 1st. This is November now. And made those decisions. The next day, I get a call from a guy, and I'm praying. I'm praying like crazy. Our board's praying. We know that we're supposed to fund these churches. We really feel called to do that. But we also know that there's just not the money there for it at this point in time. So this happens on a Wednesday. We make these decisions. On a Thursday, I get a call from a guy who I says, "Hey, Ron, can I buy you coffee? Can I meet you at Starbucks and just chat with you a bit?" And this guy has been a faithful member of our church for 30 plus years and has given regularly, but not huge, in huge amounts. But he calls, we met for coffee, and he said, "Hey, I've had a great year. My business has done extremely well. And, you know, I've been hearing what you've been talking about as far as church planting, and, you know, I would just want to pledge $100,000 towards that effort. And here's the check." So that was a really good meeting at Starbucks. That was on Thursday. On Friday, I had this lunch set up with this other member of our church, and almost the same conversation. Company's had a great year. God's really blessed me. You know, I really feel convicted that I really want to give more. And he gave me a check for $250. And that was on Friday. On Monday, I get a check in the mail for $200,000 from a guy who committed 3 years ago and never fulfilled the commitment. But his business had done better that year and things had come through. So, you know, all the money came through just in less than a week. And, you know, what that does for, I think, our board is probably way more than it does even for the church planters. Because we got to see God work in just incredible ways. And it was out of the faithfulness for realizing, you know, where that money ultimately comes from. And so it was just one of those really cool things. We were able to fund all those guys last year. We have a similar issue happening this year. So here it is, November. December, I have to raise $600,000. So again, I'm praying like crazy. But I'm trusting by God's grace that he's going to do amazing work in all that. So prayer is key. And you know, if you're not taking time to pray before those meetings with donors, during the meetings with donors, and after those meetings with donors, I just cannot emphasize that enough. That is such a big thing. And I have learned that lesson. It's amazing to me. I have to relearn it all the time. I kind of go into my strategic mode and my, you know, all those different things I do and try to cast a big vision and forget about really where the money comes from ultimately. So, you know, the big lesson here is really about prayer. Making sure you bathe it. Make sure you know that the people you're talking to are aware that you're praying about it, that you're praying for them specifically, that God's going to do a work in their life. And so that's kind of the main point, overarching point. The next one I want to talk about is just the vision. And, you know, it's funny because when we sit down with church planters, they'll bring us their prospectus or their plan, and some of them are really, really nicely done with the nice covers and, you know, full color pictures and all those great things that, you know, the boards want to see. But really the vision aspect of it is key, because I think what a donor, at least the donors we deal with, we talk about return on investment. That's something that most businessmen understand. They know if they invest in something, they want to know what they're going to get back or what they're going to see back. And I can't tell you what a better return on investment there would be in people coming to faith, right? I mean, so if you can share stories like that and show them that their money is going to result in people with transformed lives, marriages being healed, people coming out of addiction, you know, whatever those things are, it's just huge. So a clear vision is really, really important. One of the things that we do at our church, at least for me personally, when I go meet with a donor, I try to, if I can, take them on a trip somewhere. We're serving churches in 24 different countries, so we have a variety of places we can go. And oftentimes I'll ask one of them to accompany me to, you know, somewhere, India or Colombia or wherever. And the good thing about that is I get them to pay for the trip too, so it's kind of a bonus. And usually they travel way better than I normally would travel. So it goes both ways. But to take them and expose them to that and for them to see, you know, what God's doing in these different countries, or even if it's New York or whether it's, you know, Chicago, someplace where you can actually go and they can see the church and they can meet the people and understand what their investment's going to, is just a huge, huge thing. So we call them vision trips, and we do this fairly regularly. Again, it gets back to the point of them seeing where their investment dollar is going to go and seeing what benefit can result for them. Kind of that ROI type of situation. So vision's really important. We have a church we just helped fund recently. It's called the Avenue Church. It's in Delray Beach, Florida. Delray Beach is known as the recovery capital of the world. So there are more halfway houses in this community than anywhere else in the world. And It's an interesting thing is people from New York, New Jersey, the Northeast will come to South Florida for their 30-day treatment, you know, to get clean and sober. And they'll move into one of these treatment centers that are there. And then what they'll do is because they have to go to a halfway house for a period of time, they'll move into this community, which for whatever reason, they just kind of gathered there. And they'll end up realizing that Delray Beach, Florida is way better than Newark, New Jersey. And they'll just kind of stay there. And so it's become, there's 10,000 people every day to go to an AA meeting in this little city. And so there's these places all over the place where AA groups are meeting and everything. So we are seeing this, and this city is the next city next to ours. We're Boca Raton, Delray is just north of us. And literally the area that we're talking about is probably, 7-8 miles away. And as we were looking at that area, we're thinking, you know, we need to have a presence there. There's people in that community that just need to hear about Christ. If you go to, there's a street there called The Avenue, and it's where everybody goes. It's kind of a hip place where people go for coffee or for restaurants, really nice restaurants. If you talk to any one of the servers there and ask them where they came from, they'll usually say New York or New Jersey. And if you ask them why they're there, they'll usually say, I came down here to find myself or to get my act together. They'll never say they're there because they're in addiction, but they'll say something like that. So it's a community full of people that are really struggling with that issue. So we decided that we would put a ministry there, some kind of ministry, coffee house, something that we could really minister to these folks. And then I was talking to a friend of mine that was a part of AA, and he said, Ron, you guys should just put a church there. Why not plant a church there? And I thought, yeah, that's kind of what we should do. And I said, well, if we do that, would you help support it? And he said he would, so we did. So we planted a church there a couple years ago. Church has grown to 500 or so at this point in time, just in 2 or 3 years. When you walk into this church, it's amazing because it's not just people in recovery there. There's families that are there. It's on kind of the border of a diverse community. So you see a lot of multi-ethnic work there as well. But the cool thing about it is when that pastor went there and moved into the town, he went around to the halfway houses and basically said, hey, is there anything you need, anything I could do to serve you? He's done that with the city leaders as well. And the halfway houses need to have meetings. So they're required to have, you know, probably a meeting every day, I imagine. And so they said, yeah, would you mind doing a meeting? So he would just go in there and do a Bible study. And that church has just blown up. It's just incredible. It became self-funding in 1 year. Now, this is a church that's full of people in recovery, people that are living in halfway houses, but they have just opened their pockets up and given. The other thing that's happened is a lot of these people have family up in New York, New Jersey that are supporting them. And so they're so thrilled that their loved one is in some kind of church that they're sending money down to church as well because it's meeting a need that they don't have to worry about. So, you know, I think it's having a vision for something like that. It's being able to express that vision to somebody who has resources and to be able to get them fully engaged in it. So when we do that, the donors, especially the larger donors, we will make sure that they're a part of that church, that they go see it, that we share stories with them constantly, that they're fully engaged in not just the financial end of it, but more importantly, the ministry side of it, and making sure that they hear those stories on a constant basis. So casting the vision is really, really important. The other point I want to talk about is the relational aspect. While the vision's important, relationships trump vision all the time. People will give to relationships before they'll give to a vision. And you know, you can put together the best prospectus you want and have all the numbers in line and a great budget, but it's the people that you know, it's your friends and family and people in your church and that kind of stuff that are going to be your best supporters. And so building those relationships are really, really key. The problem with that is most people have a limited group of people they know. And usually for most of us, it's not the wealthy people we know. It's, you know, I don't know about you, my family, nobody in my family has any money. So I have to go outside that ring and get people that I know may have resources or know people that know people. And so building those relationships is really, really important. A couple things about that. We have another guy in our church. And like I said, I take guys on mission trips and vision trips all the time. And I've been a part of our church for 36 years, so I know a lot of people there. I know the people that, since I'm the executive pastor, I actually know what people give, which is both a blessing and a curse at the same time. But oftentimes I'll invite somebody that has resources to go on a trip with me. And just recently I was in India with a guy who owns a huge financial company, and he has four homes, has his own airplane. Anybody that has their own airplane, you want to take on a vision trip. So just kind of mark that down. So we were in India, and sitting around late one night just talking, and I just asked him, I said, hey, help me understand something. How do you work through the whole sacrificial giving thing? I mean, here you are, a guy that owns an airplane, has four homes, can pretty much afford anything you want. And I know you give generously, but what does it look like to give sacrificially? And so that turned into like a two-hour conversation, even for myself, because I'm, you know, I live in Boca Raton, for crying out loud. So I drive a car and I have a house, and I struggle with that all the time, is what does it really mean for me to give sacrificially? I've been to Haiti and Africa, and I've seen what people over there, how they give sacrificially, but for us that live in the United States, I think it's something I struggle with. But having this conversation with him was interesting, because he had never thought about that. And while he gives quite a bit of money, not only to our church, but to other ministries around the world, he'd never really thought about that aspect of it. And at the end of the two-hour conversation, he looks at me and he goes, well, I guess I could double what I give to the church. And I said, that'd be great, but is it really sacrificial? Because it's really not about the amount. You know, it's more about the heart. But still, give double, that's fine. You know, that works. So, you know, I think having relationships with people where you can have those kind of conversations is key. You know, there's a passage in, I think it's Timothy, that talks about, let's see if I can find it here. 1 Timothy 6, 18 through 19. It says, command those who are rich to be generous. Command those who are rich to be generous. And another version says, charge them. And, you know, when you think about that, I don't know that I've ever commanded somebody. I've exhorted them, encouraged them, offered them opportunities, you know, gave them reasons to give. But to really do that aspect should be challenging to us. But it shows that's your responsibility as a pastor to your people. You know, the issue for most churches is you all have enough money in your church to meet every need of your church. The problem is it's not in the plate, it's in their pocket. And so for, you know, your role is to really encourage them, just as you do in their other spiritual disciplines, whether it's reading the Bible or whether it's praying or whatever those issues are. But for whatever reason, we are neglectful in that way. And, you know, I can see over the years the opportunities that God's given me to speak into someone's life, where I've seen them step by faith into that and then have them come back to me later on and just thank me for allowing them or giving them an opportunity to do that. So I think sometimes, you know, that's just been on my heart lately about the charge them to do that. So I would just say do that with boldness and courage, trusting that God's going to do a work in their life way more than he's going to do a work in the whatever ministry that he's giving to. It's really kind of cool to see that play out that way. So the other aspects of relationship, I think for me is it's the time you invest in those relationships. When I'm developing a relationship with a donor, I realize that I first must be his pastor. So it's for me to come alongside him, pray for him, make sure that I'm there for his other needs. My ultimate goal is not to get money out of him. This is where the integrity thing comes in. Okay, the ultimate goal should not be to get money out of him. The ultimate goal should be to draw him to the throne of God, for him to understand who he needs to worship. And however that plays out in his life is the Holy Spirit's responsibility and God's responsibility, but not mine. But if I'm not pastoring him well, if I'm not leading him well, if I'm not giving him opportunities to do that, then I failed in my responsibility as a pastor and as a leader in his life. So it's really, you know, it's really incumbent, I think, to do that. When I meet with a donor, I don't ever talk about money, at least the first, second, or third time. It's me getting to know him, hearing where his heart is, helping me understand what God, what's driving him. Usually there's issues, just like us, there's issues that are going on in their life that they don't know how to handle. It could be a marriage issue or family issue, but they're all going through some kind of struggle. And so for me to come alongside and be with them, pray with them, help them walk through that journey and build a trust relationship is really, really key. And that's really what it comes down to, trust. They are probably not going to give to you unless they trust you. And trust takes time. You know, so a 36-year relationship takes 36 years to develop. It doesn't happen overnight. You have to work on it and develop it. So those relationship aspects are key. And again, I think, you know, vision's important. You got to have one, but you need to develop relationships. And it's not only people that you develop relationships to that have the resources, but it's people that know people that have the resources as well. So don't focus in on just the wealthy people. Focus in on the full body of your church when you do that. Or if you haven't got a church yet, you're still in that process. You know, get to know people and make sure that you're working with them and for them to draw them to that point. So really, really important part of it is that. The other part is strategic. You know, we talked about the vision aspect, but you need to have a plan in place, and part of that plan is to have a budget. And I know for our board, I look at budgets all the time for churches. And sometimes it's unbelievable what someone will put in a budget. You know, I've seen guys come into me that have little to no experience, and they're putting in their salary in that's ridiculous for where they're going and what they're doing. And I know the guys that sit on our board are mostly businessmen. And when you're starting a business, normally the first year you don't get paid. You know, a lot of businessmen don't get paid. They certainly don't get a pension plan or, you know, full health insurance or things like that. And I understand you need to take care of your family, and I'm all about that. But you guys need to be very, very careful when you put the budget together, not to overpay yourself, not to underpay yourself, but make sure that it's reasonable. You know, church planning is like the only thing I know of that you can pay yourself whatever you can raise. And that's not the real world. And nowhere else does that happen. And so there needs to be accountability. You know, we sit in budget meetings all the time with these church planners, and we say, you know, everything looks good, but your salary needs to come down. And because the goal is to be self-sustaining. And, you know, for us, we look at a church plant, we want to plant reproducing churches. You can't be reproducing unless you're self-sustaining. And so after the 3 years or 4 years when your fundraising money goes out, your church needs to be able to sustain that budget and that salary. And so it's really important that when you're putting a budget together, you think through not the first 3 years, but years 5 through 8 or 10. I'd really think through that, because to put an undue burden on your church at that point in time is not fair to anybody. And next thing you know, you're laying off staff in year 5 or 6. Not a good thing. So the strategic nature of that is really, really important. Think through that. I think one of the things that comes down to when it comes to working with donors too is understanding how much to ask for. I think one of the mistakes I see a lot of church planners make is they ask for too little. So it's so you need to kind of in some way discern what that donor maybe is capable of doing, whether it's a church or whether it's a private donor, whoever it is. And really ask for more than you think they're going to give you. There's something that happens in a donor's mind where they get somewhat, you know, impressed by the fact, well, you think I have more money than that? You know, that's kind of builds their ego a little bit. I'm not doing that to do that with integrity, by the way, because I'm supposed to say that every now and then. Every now and then, I'll just say integrity. So that'll help. But really, you have to know how much to ask for. And some, I know so many times I've seen guys ask for too little. And what that does, that puts a burden on their church, on their family, and everybody else. So make sure you ask for what you need and not for less than that. And don't say no for them. I know a lot of times guys will come to us and either not be prepared or won't ask for what they really need and end up leaving there with less than what they really should have. It's almost like they said, well, I'm not worth this amount of money, so I shouldn't be asking for this. So you want to be reasonable in your budget. You don't want to be over too much, too little. You have to, again, go back to prayer, prayerfully consider what that amount is, but be wise in all that and make sure you're asking for the amount they really got that you need for planting this church. So be real strategic in that aspect as well. So the other thing on strategy is launching. How many of you guys have launched already? Anybody launched our church? Okay. I know for us, you know, we will fund a church within a year of its launch, year before or year after. It's got to be within that window. One of the mistakes I see a lot of churches make is delaying the launch. You know, they want to have a core team, they want to have a launch team, whatever the terminology they're using for their ministry. But if a donor church or a donor person doesn't see activity happening, doesn't see fruit coming from it, then they kind of get worn out of that. So you really have to, when you do your strategic plan, you know, lay out your launch time, but don't delay it too much. Now, you may have to for other reasons, but be real careful about that. I know I've been very frustrated with church planners because, you know, they're supposed to launch in January. Then I call them and they say, well, we're going to delay it till Easter because Easter is a better time to launch. Then they don't hit a certain number. And next thing you know, it's September. And what we feel like is we're funding a fundraiser, you know, which is not what any donor wants to do. You know, they want to see, like I got back to said earlier, they want to see a return on their investment. So they want to see that activity happening pretty quickly. So try not to delay that too long. Have a plan. Make sure the donor understands that plan. And try as your best to stick to the plan. If things change, make sure you communicate that clearly with the donor. Don't let them hear about it through some other avenue. Make sure that you're communicating back to them regularly on that. I think one of the things that I've seen with communication is the other aspect when it comes to strategy. So I know you guys probably do prayer letters, send those out regularly, and send out your email blasts, and those are really, really important. But for some people, they need a phone call. And, you know, you need to determine who those folks are. And I'm not saying every week or every month, but make sure that you have a plan for communicating directly with those people and letting them know where you're at, what's going on, what to pray for, specific needs, and share stories with them. Every donor wants to hear stories. And so, you know, if someone comes to faith, if, you know, whatever activity happens that you want to share that, make sure that you call that donor and share that with them, because that is just an encouragement to them that God's using their money to, you know, to further his kingdom. So it's just another way of touching base. So communication's key, and the communication should never result in, hey, this happened, so send me more money. It's not about that. It's really about encouraging them that God is using their resources to do this. So it's an encouragement to them, you know, in that way. We had a situation happen recently, talking about strategic. I will look for opportunities where I think people can use their money to plant churches. So we had we have a guy in our church who owns 100 Subway sandwich shops in Northern England. So he's a franchise owner. And he lives in our city, in Boca, but he owns all these Subway sandwich shops. And I'm thinking one day to myself, if he's investing in Subway sandwich shops, why can't he invest in a church in Northern England? Now, I don't know anybody in Northern England, but I know people that know people in Northern England. So I fly over to Liverpool and meet some people, and then drive over to Manchester and meet some more people, and connect with a guy that I think would be a good partner for us. And then I find out when the Subway sandwich shops guy's going to be over in Manchester, because that's where his office is. And I said, hey, mind if I meet you over there when you're there and introduce you to some church planters? And so we did. We connected. Had the church planter share his vision to this guy. And you could just see him. He just got excited. And we started talking about investing in the area besides just making sandwiches, but actually sharing the gospel with the lost people in Manchester. It was like this whole thing opened up to him that he never thought about before. And before the meeting, as I was talking to the church planter, he said, hey, Ron, I'm going to ask him if he'll supply sandwiches for this group meeting we have every week. Think that'd be okay? And I said, no. I said, that's a dumb request. We're going to ask him for hundreds of thousands of dollars. We're not going to ask for sandwiches. You'll buy the sandwiches later. So I said, you know, we're going to go for what this church is going to cost, and that's where we're going to go. And so we got in the meeting, we laid out the plan, we made the big ask. He agreed to it. He said, I'd love to do that. And we got ready to pray at the end. I said, hey, by the way, he needs some sandwiches for his meeting. Do you think you could help him out with that? And the guy said, sure, we'd love to do that. But, you know, you go for you go for the big thing first, and then you go for the little thing later on. And I tell you what's really cool about that story is this guy, whenever he goes to Manchester, goes and visits that church. He went there for the opening of the church. And he every time he sees me at church, he says, hey, thanks for the opportunity. He says, I love those guys over there. He told me last week, he said, I'm in for another 20 next week or next year. I want to invest more money in them. So, you know, what it's done to him is amazing, you know. And he no longer talks about his sandwich shops anymore when he comes and sees me. He talks nothing about the church and what's going on. And we're getting ready to do more churches in Northern England because this guy has suddenly caught the vision for a way better way to invest his money than just making, you know, turkey sandwiches. So the other thing that we've done too is we look for who's in our church and kind of an area of interest. So we happen to have a lot of South Africans in our church that have kind of moved to Boca. And if I think I can raise money for a specific area, every place needs a church. You know, it's one of those situations that sometimes we're not strategic in the area we go into, other than the fact that if we think we can raise resources for it or there's an interest in our people, then we'll try to find a church planter there. So I flew over to Cape Town and heard of a guy that was planting a church there, and come back, and we went to our people that are South Africans in our church and kind of laid out an opportunity for them to plant a church in their home city, and we're now funding a church in Cape Town, South Africa. So it's giving people opportunities to do something they may never think about, but I think it's being ahead of that game and understanding that there's plenty of opportunities out there for us to do that if we're just very strategic in it and thinking through it. So those are kind of the points. First thing is prayer. Obviously, that's such a huge, huge thing, and I can't, you know, overestimate that enough. It's just huge. Make sure you have a clear vision. Build relationships with people on a regular basis. Be consistent in those relationships. And don't just use them for the purpose of fundraising, but use them for the purpose as you would anybody else in pastoring those folks. And then have a clear strategy as well and all that. Now it's time for questions and answers. So, yes.
Ron, we're about 7 years old, and our church is in a college town, and so we have a very different problem than you have. Half of our attendance is college students and young families. Half is college students, the other half is young families. And so we're at a point where we've been self-sustaining for basically the whole time, mm-hmm. but we have a real big vision, like y'all do, and mm-hmm. like everybody. To our attention that we're probably never going to be able to achieve that vision as long as the giving stays like it is. And I've heard, you know, Tim Keller and others talk about, like, in real expensive places like New York City, they actually have to raise a lot of outside funds. Could you just speak to, you know, what that would look like in my context and others where, you know, our people give generously. We talk about money mm-hmm. all the time, teach on it. They're faithful as part of the membership agreement, you know, so on and so forth. So they're doing it. It's just, you know, they've got $5.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, what would you say to somebody like me that may need to start thinking about how can we cultivate partnerships outside of our world?
Yeah, I think you have two resources there for that. And one is alumni. So what's a college do? The college, you know, goes back to their alumni and gets resources for their gymnasium, their library, all that kind of stuff. So you guys, you know, you've been there a couple of years, you have people that have graduated, moved on, but you've built relationships. Maybe they're not in your area anymore, but hopefully you still have a relationship with them. So I would do the alumni thing. The other thing I would do would be parents. Figure out a way of reaching to the parents of the students that are in your church. And I can tell you as a father, when my daughter went to college and she started going to a church and started telling me the great things that were happening in that church and how exciting it was for her, I'd give money to that church. I'm already giving money to the school. I might as well give money to the church too. So, I mean, I think there's opportunities there as well. I personally don't believe that any church cannot be self-sustaining. Now, it's a level of where your budget is, right? So, I mean, like you said, you have a big vision for maybe planting other churches and you want to do that. But those are two things I would look at, both the alumni and the parents. And parents are spending a boatload of money sending their kid to college. And so what's another couple thousand bucks a year? You know, so that'd be one thing. I think the other thing, too, is, those students know other people. So continue sharing that vision with the students. They have connections with other folks and stuff. So you just have to kind of lean into those relationships as well and make sure you capitalize on those. But again, if you have a vision for planting other churches and you have students who have gone through and now they're located in some other city, you know, develop that database, reach out to them, and try to capitalize on that end of it as well. So, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I think there is. I think large donors will give to projects like that more than they'll give to the regular general fund. So I think it's identifying who may be in your church that has resources like that. And we've often used a capital campaign company coming in. We've done that in our church in the past. We've found some of that, sometimes that works really well, sometimes not so much. So it's finding the right one. The kind of capital campaign is where a company comes in and does that. But you have to, you know, get somebody that fits with your culture of your church. I think all capital campaign companies are located in Dallas, Texas. So, you know, this is where you need to come to find them for whatever reason. But that can be helpful. And then you preach on stewardship and not necessarily on giving, but just on stewardship. But I do believe that, you know, you like anything, if you're going to raise millions of dollars, you need to find those guys that have the $150,000, $200,000, $300,000 gifts to give. You need it, you know, you need enough of those to make sure you're in that range. And then you just need to meet with those people and cast your vision in front of them and, you know, let them see what that can do. But that's a different type of giving than just general fund giving. You know, and you probably will need help with that in some way. At least I have needed in the past. So, yeah. Yeah.
We've had different ideas of how to produce more consistent income. Like we've done like a gala, like a dance, and raffles, fundraising. And we've even talked about if we get a building, since you know we're not using the building most of the week anyway, subleasing it to small companies, small businesses. Just because the average income, family income in our churches. Below $25,000 a year, so it's causing us to think outside the box. Can you talk a little bit about what would probably be a good idea and not a good idea as far as,
yeah,
you know, because we're having to think of new ways to.
So the question for maybe those of you didn't hear it is, they live in a low-income area, struggling with just general contributions, so what are some other alternative ways of raising money for just for the general fund specifically, right, at this point in time?
Right.
Yeah, so.
And possibly, hopefully getting a building,
yeah,
and getting another church.
So they've talked about renting their facility out, doing different things like that. And I'd say those are good ideas. We do that. You know, we have a 1,500-seat auditorium, and during the months of March through February, which is the season down in South Florida, two nights a week our facility is rented out for concerts, for ballets, for things like that. And it brings another $220,000 into the church for those 3 months. And that allows us to buy new equipment, that kind of stuff. So we don't really use it for general fund stuff, but you could do. I think you know, the business side of things like that, I think is not a bad way to go for funding, you know, creative funding things. So we do a lot of that in Haiti, Colombia, and other places where we start. We have a fish farm down there. We have a bakery. We have all kinds of things in Haiti. Every church that we plant in Haiti is self-sustaining. So they come to us once. We help them with the church building. We help fund the pastor for a year, and then we build some kind of business. So they never come back to us for more money. They are set. And now some businesses have been more successful than others. The first one we did was a rose garden. And we realized that most Haitians don't really want to buy roses. So that wasn't a good idea. So we did a fish farm, dug up the ground, and did fish farm, and that's been real successful. And we've done an ice making machine, things like that. So I think, you know, you have to figure out what the need is in your community and figure out how to meet it. And I think whether it's a coffee shop or whether it's putting a cell phone tower in your building, we've done that too. you know, whatever you can do to kind of get that extra income, I think it's fine.
So,
Raffles? Is this taped? This is integrity, you know. So, no, I don't know that we would do that, but.
It might be an important distinction too. Rob, sorry to cut in on.
Yeah,
you.
No, it's fine.
Those are all things that are going to fund one-time projects.
Right.
That's not going to help you with your month-to-month giving.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like, if you're doing a building campaign, those are good ideas to raise like $10,000 now. Mm-hmm. But that's like a one. And
yeah.
Done. Talking about one and done gift stuff. You need to cultivate what I need to cultivate.
Yeah.
And that's sustained long-term giving.
Yeah, so a business would do that. If you had like a coffee shop or something like that, although I haven't seen too many coffee shops really work that well, but something like that that's got ongoing giving. He's exactly right. So you do a dance or a dinner or whatever, and you're getting people to pay for a ticket, but it's not going to help your general fund. You know, at the end of the day, it's just going to, just like he said, it's just going to fund whatever project you're trying to raise money for. But yeah. No, we haven't. We haven't. Yeah, only in Colombia, Malawi, Chad, and Haiti, and Brazil, in some cases. Yeah, but we've seen it happen. We've seen churches do that, and I think especially if you have a facility, there's all kinds of opportunities for renting it, for using it for outside things. Of course, you have to have some clear boundaries on what those things are, and so we have really tight guidelines on who it is we'll rent to and who it is we won't rent to, that kind of thing. But no, I know of churches that have done different things, you know, that have started businesses. There's been one that started a clothing store in Jacksonville. They've done pretty well. There's been others that I've seen that have done things like that. But, you know, the part of the problem is you have to have somebody besides the pastor in your church that's going to run it. Because you don't want your pastor being a coffee barista. You know, he needs to be doing other things, So I've seen that happen too, where it's become a diversion so much, where it's taken them off the main mission of the church. Next thing you know, the church is a coffee shop with a church instead of a church with a coffee shop. So you got to be careful about things like that, because that can certainly lead you out there. Yes, you can back.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's another word from another session earlier today about scalability. And I think the issue of donors is a scalable thing. I mean, your church is a church, type of church that many people aspire to. But the churches that we've heard from here are kind of more like what most of them are like.
Sure, sure. Yeah, I think it is. I think the matter, you know, again, it's all a matter of percentages, right? So, a large gift for us in our context would be $1 million. A large gift for you would be $25,000 or less.
That would be the biggest, most enormous.
Okay, 5,000, whatever. But there are people that, you know, there are people that are, and it's not necessarily the wealthy either. I'm not talking about the people that are driving up to your car driving up in a Rolls Royce or something. It could be just an extremely generous person who's giving sacrificially and understands that. And so, you know, how do you identify those? That's a tough thing. I know for us, a lot of times they'll make themselves known in some way. You know, they'll come to us and say, hey, I've got, you know, some extra money I want to give to some project. What would you recommend I give to? Things like that. They'll somehow make themselves known. They may make themselves known by what car they drive. But not necessarily. Sometimes they may be driving a car that's well more than they need to be driving. But a lot of times it's that way. And now, because I'm the executive pastor, I have access to the giving records of our church. And I never use those for that purpose. This is on integrity, right? Okay. So I would never do that. But it's mostly through, I've been there for 36 years. So I know people. I've discipled the a lot of the guys in our church. So the capacity of relationships I have is pretty deep. And I think that just comes with time. You know, it just comes with time. So the longer you're at a place, the more of those people make themselves known to you. But I do think that I do think there's good givers in every church. You know, they're there. They may not know it yet. They may not be doing it yet, but you can help along in that process. And it just takes a while for that to happen. So, yes?
How do you encourage the pastors and elders to get more interested in money? How do you get the pastor to preach on the importance of giving?
Don't pay him for a month. No, I'm just kidding. But I think that's one of those teachable moments that pastors have to learn, and sometimes they have to learn it when the church goes through a downturn in giving, and they're forced to. That's not the best time to do it. Really, the best time to raise money is when you have a lot of money, and is when you don't need it. And a lot of times, pastors will wait till December, 25th. You know, it's Christmas Day and they're looking and they got to make another, $10,000 for their budget to be in the black. And then so that last Sunday in December, they're preaching a stewardship message with usually half the people that are normally there, right? So that's not the best time to do it. I think it's a matter of first of all, it's a teachable thing for your pastor. He's got to know that that's his responsibility. And if you point out that passage, it just says command them to do that. So it's not even an option. That's what we're supposed to do. And but the other side of it is most of them don't do it unless they really have to. And especially in the culture we live in today, because it's so uncomfortable to talk about money with people. And a lot of churches that do it get made fun of on TV and all kinds of stuff. So, there's a balance in all of it, right? You can't do it every Sunday. Or you'll be like one of those guys on TV. So you don't want to do that. But you need to do it in a way that really touches people's hearts, and really it's in context of, in my mind, it's in context of everything else you're teaching them to walk the spiritual walk, to walk the Christian walk. Read your Bible, pray, share the gospel with other people, give sacrificially, Yeah.
Early on you had mentioned raising funds through family. That would be a touchy subject sometimes.
Yeah.
In some parts of my family, Christian or not.
Yeah.
Talk a little more about how that raising funds with family would be different than maybe raising funds with people in business that you know and have a different sort of relationship.
Yeah, my only point to that was normally that's the easier path to go because people know you, they love you, hopefully they love you. Maybe not, okay. Hopefully they trust you, so there's some of that too. But I think it's, again, it gets back to two, they're not going to give to something they don't believe in either, even it's you, so. Especially if you have someone in your family who's non-believer and you're trying to raise money to preach the gospel to some, that may not be the right person to go to. So I think it's discernment on your part as to who to talk to about that need. And I have a cousin who's an atheist. I'm not going to go to him. He's my cousin. I'm not going to go to him and ask money for a church plan. He wouldn't do it. And really, it would be counterproductive to me sharing the gospel with him. My first goal with him is to lead him to Christ. It's not to get money from him. So you really got to, you got to keep the goals in mind. That's a secondary issue. The primary issue is who does he really worship? No.
How do you address that with somebody that you never met before? Just by somebody else, hey, probably this person will be awesome for you.
Yeah, well, hopefully you'll get an introduction or something from that person. Yeah.
No, but it's not your friend. Yeah. It's not somebody who you have a relationship with.
That's where the vision part comes in. So, you have to, if your introduction is made, then hopefully that person who's introducing you will, maybe clear the path for that conversation. Mm-hmm. But that's where having a clear, vision and strategy comes in. And you really need to know what you're asking for, what you're asking them for, what their involvement may or may not be. And that kind of stuff. So that happens all the time. I mean, there's always friends of friends, and they may make an investment in your church, and they say, "Well, I have another friend who's maybe interested too." And so you all go talk to them about church planting in Brazil or whatever because they went to Rio one time or something, or they like Brazilian coffee, whatever it takes. Yeah. Yeah, that's a hard one. He's talking about fundraising to retire debt. Nobody wants to pay for debt. So what we typically do is we link that to some other project. Now, we're open about it. We say, hey, here's what we're doing. We're retiring debt, and we're building this building. I have never done a fundraiser which is for debt, and I wouldn't recommend it because it's not visionary, right? I mean, it's like we made a mistake, so now we need you to pay for our mistake. That's kind of what they're hearing, you know, because they're probably not in debt, and they don't think that's the right way to live your life, so why would a church do that? And so I think, you know, for us, we had this situation years ago where we had, wasn't very much, but it was something we were uncomfortable with, and we needed a youth building. Needed to build one. So we waited until we were ready to do the youth building. Then we did a capital campaign, basically, and we outlined it. We said we're retiring this much debt so we can build this building. And it worked out fine that way. So yeah, I suggested not just do that alone, but try to find something that's visionary and purposeful for them. Oh, yeah. Yes, sir. You're not going to like this answer. You're not going to like this answer. We don't fund missionaries. So we basically, 30 years ago, we made a strategic decision to only fund church planting, and that's all we do. And so we do fund churches in other countries, but it's only through indigenous leaders, and so we're very clear on that. So when anybody comes to us for that money, we say no. Yeah, we ask them not to do that. That sometimes happens, and we will allow. So I'll just share a quick story. We have a young couple in our church. They're good friends of my children. They came to faith as teenagers. They went away to college, got married. I've known them since they were like 10 or 12, and they came back to us, and they felt called to go to Brazil to be a missionaries in Brazil. And because we don't fund missionaries, the answer was no, even though they're a part of our church. And that's a hard conversation to have because I love these kids. And but the reality is if I say yes to them, I have to say yes to a lot of other things too. And so we're very, very clear on that. This is what we do and this is what we don't do. Now, what we will allow and then what I will do for them is I'll personally help fund them out of my own resources, but not out of the church budget. And I will help them with raising money through individuals that I know. They ended up doing it, and they're there, and they're serving, and they're doing a great job. But we have really clearly defined lines on that. But when it comes to them, me giving them permission or them going and doing it, we ask them not to do that. If you know, and oftentimes, you know, they have family and friends. This is where their relationships are. So we will say, hey, go to the people that you know. But you can't send out a blank email to everybody in the church, or you can't be listed in the bulletin or things like that. Absolutely go to your family and your friends and people you're in relationship with and do that, but not beyond that circle.
When your pastor preaches on that, does he say, these are our guidelines of the church, give to the church, don't give to those other things, or how does he?
He doesn't preach that, but we talk about church planting all the time. Every Sunday almost we talk about church planting. So it's the focus. So our budget is $3.5 million, our general budget. We give $1.4 to church planting. So it's a significant amount of money that we give towards that effort. So in order to do that, we have to talk about it every Sunday, just about. We highlight it. We bring guys down to preach. We have prayer moments for church planters. We do whatever we can to constantly influence that. But so we preach from that perspective, and we try to keep them laser focused just by highlighting those stories all the time. But, you know, we have, like any church, we have people that are raised up to go out, and we will let them, you know, go to their friends and family. We ask them not to do the other, and they usually are respectful in that.
There's a very clear culture. There's a very clear culture at the Spanish River Church. The culture is church planting, and so I would assume that you don't get too much requests from inside the church.
No, well, you know, it's funny because we get requests for everything. Yeah. You know, really do. It's like any church. You know, people are looking for us to get on board their special project or whatever, and so we have to really, we say no way more than we say yes. But because of that, we can say yes in a pretty big way to what we feel God has called us to do. And You know, we have a saying that you're defined more by what you say no to than what you say yes to. Because, and I know you pastors, I mean, you probably get people asking you for, well, you know, can we do a homeless ministry? Can we do orphan care? And those are all really good things. And we actually do those locally. But we're not building orphanages in Malawi. We're building a church. And we're hoping that church builds an orphanage. You know, so it's through that local church that we feel that ministry goes out. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
What are some of the ways that you appreciate, thank donors? What are some of your guys' ways of doing that?
Yeah, I know for me, it's basically grabbing them, taking them to coffee, and sharing stories with them. And I think they appreciate that way more than you spending money on a dinner or sending them somewhere, giving them a gift. A lot of them think that, why are they doing that? You know, so what we do is I just grab time with them, even if it's a few minutes before church or whatever. And that's probably the better way to do it. I know we've done dinners like that in the past where we've hosted a big dinner, and all I get is, I can't believe we're spending money on this chicken or whatever serving. It's like, so we try to steer away from those type of things. It's personal, one-on-one, that kind of stuff. Yeah. Yes?
Mm-hmm. And I was just going to ask, have you ever had difficulty, or at least for myself, I have difficulty, not with the relationship building part, with particular people who have more resources and a means to give, mm-hmm. but the crossing over into an actual ask or like a project or saying, hey, let's go to India. And mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't want to become the friend who is like everybody else, right. Who knows that you have a means and is asking. Or the
right.
Same way in normal friendships. You've been like Christian friends, but now you're asking. Anyway, so I find myself kind of being paralyzed at the point of, this is a good project. I think this person cares. They know me. They know my heart. And crossing over.
Yeah, and I look at it a little differently. I don't look at that as an abuse of the relationship. I look at that as a relationship builder. So I just look at it from the reverse side and saying, look, you know, if this is exciting to me, then I want to share this with you. It's kind of like the gospel. I mean, you know, you get excited about what Christ has done in your life and you've gone from death to life. Why wouldn't you want to share that with other people? I look at it the same way as giving. I mean, I know what it has done for my wife and I and the joy that we get from it and just the blessings that we receive from it. I want other people to experience the same thing. So I kind of from that perspective. Let me tell you what God's doing in our life, and I'll share. I'll say Miriam and I are doing this, or we're giving to whether it's, you know, it could be Compassion International, it could be whatever. And once you start sharing those stories, and then they see the joy and the excitement, it's just an easy ask. It really is. But it's one of those situations where you got to look at it from the other side. It's not abusing it. In my way, it's enhancing the relationship. So.
For that planner to begin to identify and develop relationships with people from outside of his personal network that might be able to give.
Yeah, well, I mean, you guys are part of Acts 29, so Acts 29 is your family, and those should be your primary relationships for fundraising. So, you know, you get the list of Acts 29 churches that are close to you, hopefully the ones that have, you know, 5 or 6 years into their plant, so they're not asking for money as well, and you build on those relationships. So that would be the first place to go to, I would think. I think beyond that, it's a matter of networking with those churches or other people that you know, who knows people, who lives in that area, who has a heart for East West Hollywood, you know, who that kind of stuff. So you try to find who knows somebody who's already there, that kind of stuff. So it just takes a lot of work. You know, it just takes a lot of work, a lot of, and prayer.
Yeah. Integrity.
And integrity. Integrity and prayer, yeah.
Hey, Ron, a couple questions. We have one church plant in your city area. You know, it's been a couple years. About what time do you think, how many years, 4 or 5 years before they should become self-sustaining? Is there a, I know
Yeah, you know, you heard Doug Logan speak the other day about 8 years.
Yeah.
And so, you know, again, I think it depends on the area and the church and what your budget is and everything else. So, you know, if you're planting a church in a really under-resourced area, then you need to have a budget that reflects that. And that does, and that, what that means is way more volunteers than staff. Because staff's always going to be your biggest budget item. So you're going to have to start out with one person, or maybe a couple part-time people, or maybe they're raising their own support some other way. Like, you know, I have to be creative in it. But I do think that, you know, I haven't seen too many churches in those kind of communities that have been under 5 years. So we've kind of adjusted our schedule. Used to be 3 years. Now for some areas it's 5 years, some areas even longer than that.
Yeah. Second question I had is, because we're funding that, our budget is set up, we have an operating budget, and then the church planning, and we have three residents. That budget is coming out of every 3 year campaign.
Mm-hmm.
So now we're in our third, starting our third 3 year campaign. So if you run out of funds, then you can't fund all these projects,
mm-hmm.
right? So
mm-hmm.
to get that into the general, you know, so it's, I don't know, a percentage of the operating budget. Is
yeah.
that what you all do?
Yeah. So what we do is I mentioned, so 3.5 is our general fund budget.
Yeah.
1.4 is what we give to church planting. We take 20% off the top of what comes in our general contributions. That goes towards church planting, and then we raise the balance. And it all comes from within our church. We don't do any outside fundraising. We don't get grants, foundations, anything like that. It's going to people and saying, hey, here's an opportunity, or what would you think about investing in this? So, but the 20% is right off the top. But we don't, and just, you know, just a quick story in that, because when I talk about sacrificial giving for our people, the church has to be willing to do the same thing. And so this year we had, I had to cut $600,000 out of our budget because we had some significant people leave and some things happen. And so we didn't reduce the amount we give to church planting. We actually cut staff. That's a hard thing to do. But we believe in it so much. You know, it's what we feel God's called us to do. So we laid staff off. You know, everybody took a pay cut. Our entire staff took a pay cut so we could continue giving to church planting. So that kind of thing speaks to our people hugely. And our staff isn't real thrilled about it, but you know, they understand. That's what God's called us to do. So we're willing to make that sacrifice so that we can continue doing what we think God's called us to do.
So I think the thing with our congregation is they give. I mean, if you look at it, they give.
Yeah.
But I think their belief is that, hey, our tithe should be enough.
Yeah.
This. And we're asking them to go, like you were saying.
Yeah.
Getting them to do the sacrificial part, which is
right.
Yeah,
you got to just keep it in front of them all the time. You know, you got to, like I said before, you got to talk about it constantly from the pulpit. It's much easier to raise money for, you know, an orphanage or, you know, feeding a child or even education. For whatever reason, a lot of people don't understand why church planting is important, because they look around and say, well, we already got enough churches and half of them are empty. Why do we need more? So you have to really kind of tell why that's an issue. And then you have to show stories of what happens when a church goes in a community and how that community gets transformed. So for example, we have a church we planted in Brazil, and you saw it, there was a video that was similar to that story this morning. But that church has built an orphanage. They built a training center for economic development, and it has literally changed this entire city. And so, you know, we can say, look, we're caring for the widow and orphan by planting a church. And it's going to be ongoing forever, you know, or not, you know, as long until the Lord comes back, but not just because we have to send money every year to it.
Cool.
So you share that vision all the time about that. And I think once people understand that, then they say, yeah, church planting is important. But you got to share stories. They got to see results. I think we're out of time.
Yeah.
So thank you. Appreciate it.